Welcome to Trauma Informed Caring, an Essential Conversations podcast, brought to you by the Mid-America Addiction Technology Transfer Center, funded by SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. Although funded by SAMHSA, the content on this podcast does not necessarily reflect the views of SAMHSA.
Before we get started today, I invite everybody to close their eyes, settle in your seat, as long as you're not driving. And we're going to take a deep breath in for a count of five. One, two, three, four, five. Hold for just a moment. Go ahead and release it audibly through your mouth or through your nose, whichever is more comfortable, for another count of five. One, two, three, four, five. Thank you for participating in this grounding practice to start us off.
Thank you, Erin. I'm Roxanne Pendleton.
And I'm Andrea Dalton.
And this is Trauma Informed Caring. We are so excited for this new season where we explore trauma informed caring in unexpected places. And it is our mission to explore varied perspectives so that we can nurture knowledge and inspire courage for practical, transformative action. We are really excited about our guests today. And with that, I'm going to invite them to introduce themselves. Let's start with you, Erin. Thank you for leading us through that opening mindful moment. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
You're welcome. And thank you both so much for having me. My name is Erin Realmuto. I work at University Health, which is formerly Truman Medical Centers. I work in the public relations and marketing department on the internal communications team. So I am a communicator. I'm dual PR. I do promotions. And my focus is, my audience is the hospital staff. Everything from physicians, providers, nurses, EBF staff, pharmacy, anyone who works within the organization is who I help communicate to, whether it's for our executive leadership to let people know what's going on within the organization, or awareness weeks, whether it's Nurses Week or Infection Prevention Week. And the goal is to break down the silos, make sure that everyone knows what's going on with departments that they might not be in, and what the organization as a whole is doing at any given time. And that's me.
That's important work. Thank you so much, Erin. And you are joined by Leslie. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Leslie.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me. I'm Leslie Cardo, and I'm fortunate enough to be in the same department as Erin. I am focused on external communications, specifically patient communication and media relations. So I like to say that I communicate directly with our patients and clients, as well as reporters. Mostly my focus is local in terms of television, radio, print, online reporters. And I like to think about my job as sharing news you can use, if you will, with our providers, mostly doctors and pharmacists being the experts. So I think about things that I would, that are timely, that are trending, that are topical, things that I think that someone we have on staff would be able to make clearer or more specific. And I set up interviews and I offer them to media. And that is my focus there. And then every other week, I produce a patient e-letter called Vital KC. And again, my goal there is information that would help you lead a better life. So I am all about trying to change information from very complex, hard to understand information to information that is usable, that you can digest quickly, and that improves your life. That's me.
Thank you, Leslie. So listeners, as you can tell, we are talking about trauma-informed caring in the realm of media, communication, public relations, both internal to organizations and external.
Yeah, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation because I'm already hearing things in the way you are both talking about this. that are related to trauma-informed care. So I think the first question I'd like to ask you both to talk about just a little bit is, how did you get started with this idea of trauma-informed care in the work that you do?
This story actually involves Wesley. I don't know if she knows this. So when I first started here at University Health in 2018, I was actually in external communications working with Leslie, and I believe it was my first week, and she said, I'm going to take you to this two-day training for trauma-informed care facilitator training, and yeah. I love to learn. Like, I love to read, I love to learn, I love to take notes, love it, love it, love it. So I was like, this is what I get to do for my job. This is amazing. So I, quick backstory, in my previous life, as I like to say, I worked in TV news behind the scenes. So I have 10 years experience there. And this was a change in career, change in lifestyle. So I got to go to the amazing training that the two of you put on, Roxanne and Andrea. And I just loved it. I loved learning about things that are intuitive, but I had never thought of before. And I just, that was it. From then on, I was just always interested in trainings that you put on, how I could use that. Even in my own personal life, just made me think about mental health in a different way, be introspective about it. And yeah, so thanks to Leslie and thanks to Roxanne and Andrea, I fell in love with trauma-informed care.
I remember meeting you, and you know, that is that two-day deep dive culture change training is not what most people get at the very start. So, you know, kudos to you for being brave enough to jump right in and stick with it. And yeah, that was the beginning. How about you, Leslie?
I think I bothered you guys for interviews. I think what happened is I found out what you did and I thought, well, that sounds wildly interesting. And then like I do with everyone who I find out what they do, who I find interesting, I pestered you to death to do an interview with me. And I decided that you guys were super interesting and that your information was relevant and helpful and something I wanted to talk more about. And I believe that's why I dragged Aaron to a two-day training with you, because I thought that it was beneficial. It would be beneficial from us. Like Aaron, I come from a news background. And I don't think we ever, Aaron, I don't want to speak for you, but I'm pretty sure we never took the time to think about how our words impacted someone's emotional health. I mean, there were times when the story was really sensitive, we would, but for the most part, we were just getting it done in as little time as possible. So it's definitely a different idea, different concept. And I'm glad we did it before COVID, because I think all of a sudden during COVID, people started talking more about caring for the caregiver. But I was like, oh, I know all about this. I took that two-day class. I'm a pro. So I liked that where it came from. I liked that we were able to learn about it not during the pandemic. And I think that it was just super interesting. So I'm so glad to be here.
That makes me think about the fact that news, for the most part, that kind of communication, that background that you both came from, for lack of a better word, it is designed to get our attention. You know, it is designed to pull us in, to listen to the story and to keep us watching. And so it seems like in many ways that can go against what we try to do when we're communicating in trauma-informed ways. As we communicate in trauma-informed ways, we're trying to be sensitive to the stress impact of our words and our stories, whereas traditional news often is designed to maybe get that stress response so people hook in, right, and watch longer. And so I wonder if either of you can share anything about your journey of transitioning from, you know, being in this realm of grab the attention to this realm of be tender with your listeners. They are already hurting, right? Like, can you share any of that journey?
I think that the first time I really thought about it was maybe when I wrote an article that I had you guys take a look at. And the feedback was, hey, it would be more appropriate to say it this way.
Hmm.
And I thought, wow, look at that. You're right. Isn't that interesting? Right. Because I come from a place where not only do I want to grab your attention. I want to say in as few words as possible. And I just want to blurt it out there. And so to rethink about how you communicate is quite interesting. I would say Erin is one of the most empathetic people I know. I mean, she feels she wants nothing more than to give you what you need. And she just wants to help. She's a helper. So I think this sort of training is interesting. I saw once a documentary on these people who were raising a child with a disability, and the mom was funny. She said, you know, I don't think it's fair. She's like, I was already empathetic to people with disabilities before this. This is not a life lesson. I need it. And I think that way about trauma-informed care, like, we're not saying you just need to go out and train the jerks, right? But it's a skill set that everyone can learn from and make their communication just a little bit stronger. So that's how I saw it when I first started using it, and something that it reminds me of, that it's just, it doesn't mean you're a bad person or you're saying things purposely or you have intent. Just means there usually is a better way.
Or a way that makes people more calm or feel more safe. Part of what we've learned in the field of trauma-informed care is that if our brains are highly activated in our stress response, it's so hard for us to be logical. And it's so hard for us to access our resources and to get anything done. And usually, I think, well, many news stories are calling for action, right? They want you to get involved. Here's what's going on in the world. How can you help? And so it's kind of cross purposes. I'm going to scare you with it. Uh-oh, then the logical part of my brain shuts down. But I then want you to act and do something helpful. And so reconciling that, I think, is a huge piece of trauma-informed caring in communication, and especially in media.
This question makes me think of back when I was in journalism school, we read a book and then discussed, and I pulled it up here to make sure that I was remembering correctly. It's called The Culture of Fear by Barry Glaster. It talks about why Americans worry about the wrong things. And we talked about in class, and it makes me think of trauma-informed care, although I didn't know that's what it was at the time, perpetuating fear. So if you get on the air and you're talking about, well, I don't know, anything from a snowstorm to a tornado to a safety issue in the community, if you don't have the facts to discuss it, or if you are just conjecturing, you're creating culture of fear. And so I think that sometimes in media, I'll be honest and say we've all been guilty of it. The industry moves so fast, your day moves so fast, that you are just trying to get the information out there, best of intentions. But I feel like sometimes there's this perpetuation of culture of fear. And I think that's where trauma-informed care could really help when reporting out stories, and just like taking that moment to think about how not to, how to responsibly tell the story. I mean, all the journalists I know try to be the most responsible they can be. But again, you're trying to turn three different stories in one day. And that's not an excuse or a defense.
Well, I think as I was listening to you speak, Erin, I was thinking about how if we could just go that next step, which is not just getting the information out there, asking ourselves, what do we want the response to be? Mm-hmm. Right. And then if we want the response to be something that requires prefrontal lobe brain power, you know, logic, reasoning, action, resource, help, then just, you know, taking that extra step to consider, will these words motivate that, or will they shut the brain down more? And I thought it was beautiful the way you talked about perpetuating fear. Is it going to perpetuate fear, or is it going to create awareness and also foster safety to the extent that we can address the fear? And I think maybe just even adding that to the training would perhaps shift some of that.
I don't think that the media, I'll just, this will be maybe a side tangent, but I don't think anyone wants to change it. I think that they've got to keep you hooked 24 hours a day. So
well,
I love that we are capable of using it in our communications, because that's not our priority.
Yeah.
And so I'm happy to do it, but I don't know that there are many sales managers who are selling commercials that are going to love this concept. So we can hope for the best, but I think we might need to use it in different industries.
So that actually ties in with something I was thinking about as Erin was talking. And now that you've contributed that too, Leslie, it just makes me think, like, knowing what you know now about that and having this experience of for yourself shifting, you know, more intentionally toward being trauma-informed in your communication. When you think now about like your peers in other areas, or just even yourself in like previous experiences, or maybe even now, because I mean, no one's perfect. I can't think of any particular examples for either of you, because I think you're both spectacular, but I'm sure you mess up, right? I know I mess up, and we're not always perfect at the way we try to navigate this trauma-informed thing as we're doing it in all these different areas. But how then do you kind of, I don't know, reconcile that just in yourself, maybe, you know, knowing that you've been part of a system that does go toward those more
for the thrill, for the shock.
Yeah.
Yeah. It activates the stress response for sure.
Yeah. And what I'm getting to here, just before I pass it over to you to comment, is the idea of moral injury, which we talked about quite a bit in our last series, our last season of this podcast. But I think it ties in really well here too, with this idea of like, we learn more and then we try to do better. And then we recognize like all the ways that so much of the systems are still traumatizing or re-traumatizing people or triggering people as we're maybe again, with the best of intentions and maybe not all the time.
I don't know that I was a reporter. And so I covered, you know, anything that was happening. They'd say, go see what's happening, but make it quick. Go do a really good job and be fast about it. Fast as you can. And so I think about, there are a couple specific interviews that pop out in my head that I think that would have never, either I would have said I'm not doing it, or it would not have been possible to use trauma-informed language, because it wouldn't, for example, it wouldn't be me interviewing someone on camera who had been sexually assaulted the night before and talking about the experience when I had maybe 3 minutes to talk to her before I put her on camera. I today would have said, what? We can't interview this woman. And of course, everyone wanted the interview. So we interviewed her. And I didn't even think twice at the time. I thought, oh, good. I'm glad she'll talk. And I remember being empathetic to her and thinking, I have so much compassion for this woman, right? Mm-hmm. Again, intentions. There are a couple other interviews. I think, you know, when there's a death penalty sentencing and you ask the family, so what do you think about this? What do you think they think about it, Leslie? Right. You know what I mean? But you have to answer the question. And I remember I used to always try to use the phrasing, what do you think about it? Because how do you feel about it was so cliche and stupid. I thought that maybe just changing that one word would make a difference. But the intention is the same. It's to get someone to react and to get their feelings about something. So yeah, there's a lot of moral injury when I think back to the interviews I did and questions I point blank asked people, and number of times I knocked on doors and I said, oh, hi, I know your child was just killed in a car crash. Do you want to do an interview? It was icky. For me, there is no effort to change it because it is what it is. It's a local news, especially, is a product to be sold, and it needs to be sellable thing. I think people, good journalists throughout the years have tried. Carol Marine in Chicago, when I was growing up, changed the 10 o'clock news. She took over and they were going to just do in-depth stories that really mattered beyond just the headline. And that maybe lasted a month because people are just used to what they're used to. So I think it's I'm not putting a lot of effort into changing the landscape of television news beyond offering interviews that I think have substance. I think that's all we can do from my angle. I don't know. Erin?
Yeah, I agree with Leslie. Is on this side of what we're doing now is to be able to offer these stories that will still fill a newscast, that will still grab attention, but show more humanity. I like to, couple cliche things that rattle around in my brain a lot. One is, we say in our house a lot, we did the best we can with the information we had at the time.
Yeah.
So 23-year-old Erin calling a murder victim's family, 25-year-old Erin calling murder victim's family, tried the best she could. Not to defend, but would I do that completely differently? Yes. Would I like to think that I would have a voice in the newsroom to talk through before we even sent Leslie out on that story to talk through? I'd hope so. I hope that I would, knowing what I know now, be brave enough to do that. But again, like Leslie said, like that is local news. The other thing that I say a lot in my head is, for any industry, you can teach the skills, but you can't teach the passion. And I had such a passion for TV news, and I saw it as a public service, and I know many journalists do, and I still believe that. Yeah. But my passion was gone. I knew it was time to move on.
Which leads me to the question that's been bouncing around in my head as I've listened to both of you, and it has to do with the impact on you of seeing, hearing about, interviewing, and reviewing, working on, and then reporting on these exceptionally painful and traumatic stories. You alluded, Erin, when you introduced yourself, I think when you said you changed your lifestyle and took a different kind of job. And I wondered if that was maybe a piece of it, the secondary trauma that you might have experienced. So I want to invite any comment on that, or just your awareness of what's going on in the industry. Is there anything that the industry does to help reporters and all the people who are creating these stories cope with the impact that has on their nervous system, on their well-being? So either of those.
I'll start with the first one. I don't know how deep we want to get here, but in 2015, 2016, I went through a couple personally really hard years. And I came out of that in 2017. And I just, again, what I didn't really know, I kind of assumed burnout. And I just remember thinking to myself, I did not go through all I went through to come to this particular job and go home crying every day, driving in crying every day. And now that's not to say that my coworkers weren't amazing. They were. They're my family. I still talk to them. And that's what I love about it too, is that once I left, I'm still like family with those people. I would do anything for them. And so it wasn't about that, but it was about the work and what I was doing. And that was my aha, as people say, that it was time for me. The passion was no longer there. I had worked really hard in my personal life to overcome some things. And I thought to myself, but for what? Why did I work so hard? If the life that I've created or the life that I've battled for is this miserable? And so that was when it was time for me to leave.
It's ironic that she says that, because what made me want to hire her was that she kept a very positive note on the other side of her computer. So people would come and approach Erin. She'd be on one side of the computer figuring out all the chaos of Kansas City news during the day. And they'd come up and probably complain like, I need to get a lunch break. Can I get a sandwich? And Erin would be like, no, go to this fire. But she always kept a positive quote on the side. And that was one thing that stuck out to me. Like, you had something positive. Even through all that, you tried to push some positivity, some good vibes, some good thought, some good feeling into the newsroom every day. So I just wanted to add that. I think that's cool about you.
Oh, thank you. I didn't realize that made such an impact. That makes me happy. I put a quote of the day on the board because usually I'd have a line of a couple people deep coming up to ask me questions about a million different things. And I was like, well, maybe they should have something to read while they're
reading material.
Yeah. I wanted to get like a ticket taker, like the deli. Yeah. But I never got that far. So anyways.
You never know how one little thing you do, though, impacts people. It's so nice to hear the feedback about that. Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that. So Leslie or Erin, what about the other question? Is there anything that you're aware of that's being done for reporters or people who are creating the stories or researching the stories? I mean, there's a whole team. It's just not the person in front of the camera, right? There's a whole team of people that are interacting with this very sometimes upsetting material. Is there anything being done in the industry to help people understand what secondary trauma is, how to protect against it, how to release it? Are you aware of anything?
I'm not aware of anything. I think that, like Erin said, the people around you become your family. And I think that's always become the coping mechanism. And luckily, being able to talk it out and process it at the end of the night. There may be some things in place. I don't know about them.
I know that I've just heard from friends that there's like EAP programs, as most jobs have, and they will have like 3 or 4 therapy sessions for free. And I'm using my air quotes here that are offered, that is great, period. However, it's still a process, as we all well know, getting mental health care and appointments. And one of the things that's challenging in news is you don't get to leave at one to go to your therapy appointment. So I know that those things are being offered. And follow up with that, just to say that was another thing when I got here. Leslie was like, oh, okay. I was like, I have an appointment at 3. And she's like, all right, bye. I'm like, what? You know, so just that like life balance. All that to say that there are things in place, how easy they are to access, I'm not sure.
Every generation is going to change the way they do things, probably. And so as we usher in a new management, if you will, or a new way of thinking about things, or there may be some changes, and it may come from kind of a grassroots, hey, we need help. We need, you know, you need to keep us strong so we can keep doing our jobs, right? I don't know, maybe that would do something.
I do, as I'm, you know, curating our newsletter and things like that, I come across articles, opinion pieces, you know, lots of things from time to time that do talk about how to better equip people who are working in media to manage secondary trauma or to shift into more trauma-informed practices, not just in their reporting, but also, you know, in the environment, in the culture. So I think it's out there. And I wonder if it's, you know, it's not an industry that we have probably collectively as a society really thought about as a need area for something like trauma-informed practices. And so I just think like, it's just a little further down the path, right? I look back 25 years ago to like the mental health field. We didn't even really talk about taking care of our providers at that point. And so we've come a long way, I think, in that area. Not that it's perfect now, but that awareness building has to start somewhere. And so maybe that's where the media industry kind of is at this moment, is kind of that beginning stage of building awareness. Hopefully, you know, things like this podcast episode, you know, other publications, you know, we'll keep putting them out there as we find them, because I think it's tremendously important. And honestly, I probably think it's tremendously important because I've had these interactions with you two and have been able to think about that a little bit more intentionally. So thank you to both of you for opening my eyes to that area.
So I'd like to shift now from focusing on media to focusing on communication internally, just for a few moments. And I'm wondering if you can share with us, well, first of all, let me say, I, as an employee of University Health throughout the pandemic, was very impressed and grateful for the way that there was such continual communication with us. You know, in the midst of something that was unprecedented, no one knew what to expect or what was happening next or what was happening day to day. And I don't know how big a part of that you were, Aaron or Leslie, but if you weren't part of it, I'm sure you know the people who were. I feel like our organization did a really good job continuing to communicate with us day to day. Here's what's going on. Here's what's changed. We don't know this. We're going to figure this out tomorrow. But just that constant talking with us and making us aware of what senior leadership were doing, what the hospital was doing, what was happening in the community, that built, at least within me and those of my colleagues that talked about it, a sense of trustworthiness in our leadership, that you're sharing with us what's happening. And some of the programs that have, you know, come out since then, like the fly on the wall conversations, where we get to hear senior leaders talking about things that are coming, you know, all of that work you've done to help be transparent, to help communicate what we know now, and to keep communicating, that builds a sense of safety. And so first, I just want to say thank you and kudos to you and everyone involved in that. And then that leads me to my question. Is there something that goes through your mind? Do you have a kind of checklist internally, even, of when you're reviewing what you're going to send out? How do you look at it through the trauma-informed lens before you send it out? I know Leslie shared that she asked us to review something long ago, but you haven't asked us for that in a long time. So we want to know, you know, what are you thinking as you're sharing this information? And could that help our listeners? You know, are there two or three things that you ask yourself, or what are you checking for before you send out some kind of communication?
Yeah. So first of all, thank you so much for saying that. And I will say the credit goes to the entire PR and marketing team, whether we are internal, external, marketing, we all jumped in, we all used our strengths. And so thank you so much for saying that. And it was, our team was just great. So we all, you know, had a part in that. I will say that where trauma-informed care, where I utilize it the most as far as internal communications, a couple places. One, when I'm writing or when I'm reading something that someone asks me to look over, is the inclusivity of the writing, making sure that people don't feel like talked down to, or, you know, like, or if we're using words, I'm one of the, I'll go back to my media training. Right at a fifth or sixth grade level, for a couple reasons. When I got into healthcare, there are so many acronyms. I don't know what any of that means. So even if I'm writing to someone who started yesterday and I'm writing to someone who's been in the organization for 20 years, so I'm going to be writing for that person who started yesterday. I'm going to try to spell out the acronyms. I'm kind of going to try to explain some. I'm not going to take for granted. I never like to assume anything. I don't assume that you know what X, Y, and Z means. And if you do, that's great. The other thing that I really work on in internal communications, and I'm really passionate about, and Leslie will tell you this too, is that I meet people where they are. And I think that I really learned that a lot from trauma-informed care. I, again, going back to my media roots, I worked overnights. I worked weekends. I worked weekend overnights. So if we're highlighting a nurse or someone who comes in at 7 p.m., okay, I will be here at 7 p.m. It's not, I don't want that person who already has a really challenging job to have to like stay late for me. You know, I'm very lucky in the job that I have and the hours that I am able to have. So if I stay a little bit late, that's okay. Because 5 years ago, for 10 years, I was staying late every day. So that's fine. If I can help that person come in, be quick, and recognize them on a weekend, I'm not saying I do it all the time, but just the, I'm rattling on, just meeting people where they are is something that I really try to do in my job. Because they're doing the hard work, right? They're saving lives, taking care of patients. I'm just celebrating them. So I'm, and I love to do it.
For me, I think that it's, what I'm trying to do is help people understand. Erin hit it on that. Healthcare is so confusing and it doesn't mean to be, but does the average person really understand like what you do when you have your labs drawn and where they go and who reads them? And then, you know, a radiologist reads your scan, your imaging, and then they report it back to your primary care. Who knows all of that? So I think it's empowering to people to explain the behind the scenes a little bit, to help them to write it, even if it's an extra sentence or two, which, you know, as journalists, we try to keep it as tight as possible, to explain a little bit more about the process or to leave a little note at the bottom, you know, to make an appointment. Here's exactly where you need to go. The other thing I think that is so, it is so simple, but I think it's so important, is a sense of humility when you're giving people wayfinding directions. Hospitals, I don't care which hospital you've ever been in your entire life, it's never a straight line from A to B. And so I always tell people, I make sure I always say, and this is true, I got lost for the first month I worked here. And me giving you directions doesn't mean I'm like, you know, Ferdinand Magellan and I can figure everything out. It just means I've been here a million times and I'm just going to show you how to do it. And I'm happy to do it. And while we're walking, can I get you anything? So I think that is very helpful. And I think makes people, I know I feel better. I feel safer. I feel more relaxed when someone's going to walk me somewhere, talk to me a little bit, as opposed to just pointing down the hallway and saying, go down there. So that's another non-written way that I think trauma-informed care has really played out.
I think that's brilliant. I remember when I was traveling in foreign countries, and one of the most important phrases we all needed to know is, where is the bathroom? Like, right. How do I say that in the language of the country? And I think it's kind of funny, but it really does highlight the fact that we need our basic needs to be met in order to feel safe, or we at least need to know that we can get them met. And one of those basic needs is am I going to be lost? Do I know my way out? Do I know where I'm supposed to meet someone? I don't know if I'm going to be able to be on time because I don't know where I'm going. And so all of the stress that comes with that. I mean, just think about the stress of finding a parking place at a new location. So all of that is actually a very trauma-informed way because you're thinking about the stress response. You're thinking about creating safety. I loved how you said, when I worked here for the first year, I got lost all the time. You normalized
because I still get lost.
I do too.
I get lost.
And then people, for 9 years. Yeah. And people feel so self-conscious and then they feel stupid and then that's a threat and then they feel shame and then their brain shuts down. And so all of that, it seems like such a small thing to do, but it's actually so powerful neurobiologically. You know, you're normalizing their feelings, you're helping calm their feelings, you're building just those moments of relationship when you walk with them and then you say, can I get you anything? Again, what if they're thirsty? What if they do need to use the restroom? That kind of thing. I think those are really great pieces of advice. Thank you both.
Selfishly, I just want to follow up on that. Selfishly, it makes me feel better to do all that, though. You know, I don't know that technically I am doing, I know that it is a good practice and for the reasons you just said, but also if I can get you something else too, I feel like I've done a little something that day. So I do, selfishly, it makes me feel good to help. If I'm going to keep talking about, Erin has been really involved with CHSI, which is our Community Health Strategies and Innovation, as well as, I'll give you another acronym if I haven't given you enough, SDOH, Social Determinants of Health. SDOH means instead of us just thinking about you getting your medication and going home and being better, we think about, do you have transportation to get here? Do you have enough food? Do you have a cultural practice that makes it difficult? What is getting in the way? What are the barriers? And I think of when I approach something, either a person or I'm writing something, and I have to assume that all those things are barriers to my reader, I think that's helpful. And I will thank Erin for getting me involved with those groups because they're pretty awesome.
They are. And I just want to say too, I don't think it's entirely selfish doing those acts, because acts of compassion feed your compassion also. And so it I think contributes to a general culture of compassion and care for each other. And, you know, Roxanne and I and our department, we've been talking about community care a lot in the last year or two, especially, and just how important that layer of self-care, if you will, is that we're not just taking care of ourselves, we're taking care of each other too. And that's an important part of how we are well as a system, as a community, as an organization, you know, wherever we are.
Can I turn the microphone around for a minute? Because I'm going to, because you knew this was going to happen.
So
for listeners, I'm so much more comfortable on the other side. Look at how I just was like, okay, enough about me. For our listeners, though, who may be new to this podcast, if this is a new season, right? Where did you guys get involved with trauma-informed care? And when did it click that it was something that you needed to do and teach and be part of?
Well, it started for me. I worked in the state hospital system in Kansas for quite a while as a music therapist. That was my first like big job out of graduate school. I had another little job. But what I started as an activity director in a nursing home, they weren't really talking about trauma-informed care there yet. That's more of a conversation that's happening now, I know, in those areas. But mental health, especially state-run mental health treatment, was one of the first areas that SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, was rolling out their trauma-informed care programming and trainings and things like that. And so I went to a training and thought it was going to change everything about the way we did our treatment. Our system was going to totally change. And of course, it didn't happen because you don't change overnight, first of all. And it's not just about training. And I've always just been really interested in systems and the way things intersect. And, you know, as I learned more, I started to see like how valuable putting the principles of trauma-informed caring into play was in all of these different areas. And the more I learn, the more I'm like, oh, what about trauma-informed care in this place? I mean, this is part of the reason we're doing this season of the podcast, is that we really, I think Roxanne shares that passion with me about, you know, like, look at all these different ways that we can make everything in our society function better, contribute to well-being, keep people in a place where they feel good and calm and can connect with each other in really authentic ways, versus the kind of like divisive, bitterness that has taken over in so many areas of our lives. So trying to be like the optimist in the face of a lot of bad stuff. I'm not always good at that. I have a cynical streak, but I don't know. Roxanne, you want to share a little bit about yours?
I was just checking about your cynical.
not share a little bit about your cynical streak, but share a little bit about your history of trauma-informed care.
Yeah. So my history is a little different. I worked for 23 years in local communities before coming to work in behavioral health at the hospital. My role was mainly as a local church pastor, although I did have some time working as a hospice chaplain and some time working as a hospital chaplain. And so my role was often supporting people in the midst of trauma. You know, when people have something terrible that happens, they'll call 911, and then often they will call someone from their faith community. And so I did a lot of support for people who are experiencing horrible, horrible things. And I also noticed over the years that caregivers in my congregation and in my community were getting sick. I noticed that they were suffering from things that I did not have words for. Now I know it is secondary trauma. Now I know it is vicarious trauma. Now I know it is compassion fatigue. But I just noticed we, frontline caregivers, were getting sick, and some were leaving their professions, which was terrible because they were really good at their jobs. And others, I was doing their funeral because it literally, the work, either through chronic illness or hopelessness, actually end their life. And I started, I think it was in 2008, I know it was in 2008, specifically praying that someone would be able to help the caregivers. Who's out there taking care of those people who are dealing on the front line with trauma day in and day out? And based on our conversation, that includes news reporters, by the way. You know, it's the traditional people you think like, oh, doctors, nurses, firefighters, police officers, but it's also parents. It's also daycare providers. You know, it's also all those people who work with animals, like all activists, right? And including ministers. And so I started really trying to find ways. I had my own experiences of severe mental illness and recovery, and I'd been talking and speaking in the community to fight stigma and raise funds. And through that work, I met Marcia Morgan, who was then the COO of Truman Medical Center's Behavioral Health. And she was part of a group that was instrumental in bringing trauma-informed care to the state of Missouri and creating something called the Missouri Model, which is a developmental model of implementing trauma-informed care in organizations, moving from unaware or even trauma-inducing to trauma-aware, trauma-sensitive, trauma-responsive, and fully trauma-informed. And she created a role on the behavioral health acute care units, which those are the units, the locked units for folks who are experiencing severe mental illness. So they're adult units there that we have at the hospital. And she noticed that the work was very, very hard on the staff. And there was a lot of turnover. There was a lot of trauma. There was a lot that was going on. And so she created a role to bring someone in to focus on the caregivers. And in the work that I did with her, she reached out to me and said, I had this wild idea. You're going to love it or hate it. And I always like conversations that start that way, by the way. So lay it on me. And she said, you know, we have these units that are very acute and the caregivers are really suffering and we're looking for someone to take care of the caregivers. And it was literally word for word the prayer I had been praying. So watch out when you pray. You may be the one that you're waiting for. And so I stepped in and said, yeah, I'll try it. I didn't know anything about trauma-informed care. I'd never heard the terms. I didn't know about the movement or the research. I learned that in the midst of the work. And I will tell you that as I learned it, it made everything I'd ever experienced in my life make sense. My background in science, my background in religion, my background in counseling, my own experiences, the impact that the work had on myself and other caregivers, all of it, the science, it all came together. And suddenly I realized that that was the missing piece, that we didn't understand the neurobiological impact of trauma on the brain, on the body, on behaviors. We didn't understand how to create a culture where we helped people feel safe so that they could have strong relationships so that their brains could calm down so that they could thrive. We didn't understand how to collaborate or give choice or empower people. We certainly weren't teaching our frontline caregivers how to take care of their own trauma and their own well-being. And so it became something that, because it made everything else that I cared about make sense, it became the passion of my life. And so working to implement that on the units for the first 3 years, and Andrea joined me in that after a couple of years. And then we were invited to move into the Center for Trauma-Informed Innovation once it was founded to bring this work to the broader community.
All right, I'm done with questions, but I loved that. That was
thank you. No, thank you.
She didn't warn us about that.
Thank you for asking. All right. So this has been a fantastic conversation. We're really excited about hearing more about this sort of emerging field, I would say, related to trauma-informed caring, and definitely an unexpected place probably for many people. So a few takeaways that we have from our time together today. The first was really about how there is this underlying fear-based communication in marketing and media and PR to grab attention, and how that is very much different than a more trauma-informed practice of communication that creates safety, that builds a sense of trust, and actually gets people's brains in a place where they can access executive functions, so that our stress response is not lit up all the time by the constant barrage of fear and stress and overwhelming information that we get, but that we're able to manage that in a way that keeps ourselves able to cope with whatever it is that is going on in the world.
Yes. And the second takeaway is that we have an opportunity. We have a huge opportunity to help those who are reporting for us, who are bringing us the information about these very traumatic events and these situations that can activate a fear response. And whether that's external media or even within an organization reporting on things that the organization is facing. And it might not be something as terrifying as a pandemic. It could be an organizational change because you were bought by a new management team and now there are all these changes coming down the pike. I mean, this is applicable across the board. There is an opportunity to help those who are bringing us the information to navigate their own secondary trauma, learn to protect against that, learn to release that, learn to care for themselves so that they can have less fatigue and more satisfaction and more well-being.
And then our third takeaway we decided was the collection of tips that Leslie and Aaron shared around trauma-informed communication strategies, especially in writing. But I think this is also true for verbal communication. So considering inclusivity, making sure that the information is going out to people in a way that they can receive. So avoiding acronyms or defining acronyms, explaining terms, don't assume that people know what you mean. Meet people where they are. Also, I love that tip, Aaron. Not just when it's convenient for you, but when it's convenient for them. Being in the space with the people who you are trying to connect with, like get to know what it's like for them in their work, in their area, because it's probably a lot different than what you're used to or what you've expected. And then also giving clear directions and being helpful, helping people find their way, offering what can I get you right now? Or is there anything that you need? And just a sidebar on that, that again, it might make you feel good to help. And that's okay too, because it is all about that community of care that we have for each other.
All right. So one final question for each of you to consider. The topic this season is trauma-informed caring in unexpected places. What has been unexpected for you on this journey? And it could be something external or it could be something internal. But what has been unexpected for you?
I'll go first. The thing that's been unexpected for me is internal, how I've been able to utilize what you teach in the trauma-informed center for my own personal journey. Like I mentioned, I changed careers as part of my personal journey, and not to go too long, but recognizing that trauma isn't just military service. It isn't just violence. Although, of course, it is. There are other elements that are trauma, that are traumatizing, learning about ACEs. And so applying that filter to my own life and my own personal journey, and then using it outwardly to recognize that others are going through invisible things as well.
Thank you, Erin. And ACEs, for our listeners, could stand for adverse childhood experiences. It could also stand for adverse community experiences, adverse climate experiences, adverse cultural experiences. Most recently, we were hearing a group of pastors talk about adverse church experiences. And so any of those spaces in which you can face adversity to the extent that it impacts your nervous system in such a way that it is received and experienced as trauma, those are things that can impact health and well-being over the lifespan. Thank you, Erin. What about you, Leslie? What has been unexpected for you in this journey?
Two things. The first thing that I would say is unexpected, and also this is kind of a plug for trauma-informed care, if you will, is that this isn't an extra step that makes your job more difficult, right? There are so many things people will come up to a writer and say, you need to incorporate X, Y, and Z. And now you need to think about it in this way. And you think, okay, now I've got to work a little bit harder. I would say from my experience, it simply is just taking a moment to think and to consider and to be considerate. So I would say for any professional, a health writer, any sort of communicator, I would say this is not something that's going to make your job more difficult. You can do a two-day training. You can not do a two-day training. You can read about it. You can think about it. But in my mind, that's not something that's going to slow you down. It's not going to cost your organization more money. Yeah. The second thing that I would say was surprise to me, the power of taking a grounding moment. So I run fast. There's a Diet Coke on my desk at all times. I think I need to get things out as quick as possible because also I'm a little nervous and I like to check things off my list for the anxiety. So I just don't stop. And the first time I was in a workshop with you guys and you said, put your feet on the floor and ground them. And close your eyes and take a breath. I thought, well, this is silly, but that it works. It gives you a moment to be fully present. Mm-hmm. And I think being fully present these days is a gift. Mm.
Yes. Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you, Leslie. And thank you, Erin. Both for your tips here at the end or the things that you've highlighted. I think those are really important. And throughout this whole episode. It's been really great to hear your wisdom and your experiences. So thank you so much.
And I would say thank you for doing the work you're doing as pioneers in trauma-informed Truly. Communication. You are, whacking away the brush, right? You're making that path. And everything you do, I want you to remember this, every change you make is making it easier for those coming behind you. So thank you.
And also always feel free to send me a note if I get something wrong.
Same. We always invite that. That is a mutual request because we do have a responsibility to each other too, right? Like we're in this work together. So we hold each other accountable. I appreciate that a lot. Thank you. And thank you to our listeners for joining us for this episode of Trauma-Informed Caring. We invite you to check out all the resources that are available on the MidAmerica ATTC website. You can also access our virtual room of refuge, where you can find a variety of support for your own well-being, access our YouTube channel, and subscribe to our newsletter, Conscious Connections. Thanks for joining us. It is our hope that where you work and where you live, this podcast will offer you practical support for the practice of trauma-informed caring.